Welcome to SaaS Open Mic by ChartMogul. I'm Ed Shelley. Today I've got a packed episode for you, and I'm really excited to have had the opportunity to sit down with Arun Mani of Freshdesk. Arun is Managing Director of Continental Europe at Freshdesk, leading the company's expansion into the European market. But the path leading to his current role is full of pivots, reinventions, and discovery, from designing chips at Intel to being a C-level strategy advisor at McKinsey. In this chat, we talked about how to approach SaaS expansion into Europe and the parts most businesses get wrong with their approach.
Because I do firmly believe that if you approach Europe as one mega region, like we can get away with treating United States as, you are bound to fail.
How mentorship has played a huge role throughout his career and how others can find their feet with it.
But it's always nice to have a coach who can look at things differently, who can come out of your mental bubble.
How he built a fundamentally diverse team from scratch.
We didn't tweak any criteria at any point in time to hire somebody because they are from a diverse background.
Yeah.
We opened our eyes to make it look, to look for everything that's out there.
There's all this and much more in the discussion. So let's get into the episode. Now, here's Arun Mani of Freshdesk. Arun, thanks so much for joining me here in the ChartMogul office. It's really great to have you and can't wait to dig into some of these things.
Thank you. I really appreciate you having me here. Very excited as well.
So it probably makes sense to start a little bit at the beginning and give some people context of what you do and perhaps what Freshdesk does as well. So what's your focus at Freshdesk and what are you doing here for Freshdesk in Europe?
Sure. About myself, I always describe myself as an engineer at heart and problem solver. And almost the last 5-6 years, I'm more like a sales leader. I'm the managing director for Continental Europe for Freshdesk and based in Berlin. What do I do here? Freshdesk has been one of the fast growing companies. We are currently at 100,000 customers. That's in a span of 6 years, primarily inbound. And as a product matures, we are getting increasingly pulled into mid-market or even enterprise situations. So the sales motions are obviously different, and our need to cater to the local market also increases as we actually increase our footprint in Europe. So my job is to create a hub for our operations in Berlin to cater to the wider European market.
There's one thing that's interesting here is the kind of theme of expansion to Europe. Obviously, like Freshdesk hired you to basically start that and lead it. I'm interested to know, like, what really came first there? Was there a strong demand already and you saw a lot of uptake in Europe and then saw the need to have a presence here? I guess on a higher level, how does a company like Freshdesk approach expanding to Europe?
I think the typical growth story for most companies are you find it in Europe and you grow in Europe. In US. Did I say Europe? so I'm thinking Europe first. So it was mostly from America, and you continuously improve the product adoption for the marketplace. Then the typical expansion points are basically other English-speaking countries where actually the law are also not that different. So you can think of countries like Canada, UK, and Australia. When they think about Europe, oftentimes the Nordics and the Netherlands behave very similarly in terms of faster adoption and so on. Most companies don't think about mainland Europe until that point because the upfront investment required is pretty high to basically not only translate your product, but actually have to localize. There are very strict data protection and data privacy laws, which can actually pretty onerous on an early stage firm, especially if it's a cloud-based firm. So that's the typical path. For us, it's surprisingly, I don't know whether you know the story, when our product was built and put out for adoption, I think the first customer came from Australia. So I think the first 5 customers or so came from 5 different countries, so to speak. So the company has been global from day one. And when we decided to grow it to Europe, I just wanted to check, you know, how much of an adoption. We were surprised to find we have almost a third of our customer base in Europe. Mm-hmm. And it shows the tremendous power of, you know, a product being tuned to the local, let's say, typical things like language-specific features. Mm. And also through our both inside sales and also reseller channels. Mm. So we're able to take it up to that level just using those. Mm-hmm. But like I said earlier, increasingly we are getting pulled into larger enterprises where the people want to see, and we are deploying, you know, the classic sales approaches mm-hmm. for those stakeholders.
Okay, so it's really that transition to more enterprise focus that
Correct.
Gives a need to actually have like feet on the ground here.
Correct. I would say both mid-market and enterprise. Mid-market companies, especially which are on good growth, mm. act and behave like enterprise companies in many scenarios. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, at least they want to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, I read an AMA that you did recently on growth hackers, which is really interesting. I think for anybody out there, they should definitely go and read this if they want to get more background on your role at Freshdesk. You wrote something about the European market, which I found really interesting. I just want to read that quickly. You said it's super fragmented with stark regional differences in terms of market maturity, business cadence, business landscape, and regulations. And on top of this, you have all of the cultural differences. So you said it's incorrect to approach Europe as a single market in the first place. There's clearly like a lot of barriers there or humps to get over. How did you approach that for Freshdesk? How do you solve those problems?
Yeah, thanks for referring to that, because I do firmly believe that if you approach Europe as one mega region, like we can get away with treating United States as, you are bound to fail. Mm-hmm. Primarily because the way I sell, the way I operate in New York is not that going to be different from the way I operate in California. Mm-hmm. But if you can't say the same for Europe. And if you try to cover many regions, you're going to be stretched too thin, and you're going to be in a scenario where nobody's going to be super satisfied. The way we looked at this, we looked at the market and said, well, Germany's the biggest within continental Europe. And it's probably also the most toughest market for any SaaS player. But we said, let's focus on that primarily because we want to win in this market and we know it's going to take time. So we have to start now. Mm-hmm. So for us to reap the benefits, 6-18 months from now. Meanwhile, we said, well, it's also good for us to put some points on the board, see whether our models work, what is working, what's not working. So we picked the Nordics and Netherlands as two, I would say, counterweight. They're relatively smaller markets compared to, let's say, the German-speaking market in general. Mm-hmm. But the characteristics and, the rate of adoption, the decision-making pace, ease of doing business with English, all these are actually much more favorable. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of think of it as you're kind of dipping the toes in Europe, so to speak, and you're getting slowly exposed to the regulations, multilingual product requests and so on by exposing yourself to Nordics and the Netherlands.
Right.
But then you go really hardcore and deep into how the level of diligence, the deal cycles are different in Germany, mm-hmm. where, let's say a case of, in a typical on-premise scenario, you take a product and make it 100% customized for you. By definition, most SaaS products basically out of the box plus configuration can get you to 85%, let's say. The remaining part is totally dependent on your platform capabilities, your integration partners, and all the things that comes around with it. Mm. And the German market will test you really hard because they want to get it right to the 100%.
Right.
And that's been our learning, and we continue to learn a lot and go along with it. So now if you consider Southern Europe, it's an entirely different market. Probably you are going to be spending a lot more time educating on SaaS versus others. Mm-hmm. So they are probably slightly behind in the adoption curve. So mm-hmm. net-net, what we found is we cannot do justice to, spread ourselves in the Italian or Spanish market without really, really having all the resources between our product customization, marketing collateral, onboarding and training and support resources and even any kind of regulatory differences and so on and so forth. So it's you have to approach each and every country independently.
Mm.
And that's how I do our approach for Freshdesk.
It seems pretty clear to me that it's a very long game that you're playing with this.
It is. Yeah. It is.
And if there's any American founders out there that are considering the European market, you've probably just scared them off for a few years. But I would love if you could quickly give an outline of your personal career so far, because I think it's really interesting. And there's a few themes there that definitely seem, whether kind of deliberate or not, very kind of relevant to what you're doing at Freshdesk today.
So I would say if I go to first principles, I didn't have much of a in India, where we grew up, you are basically, you're either a doctor or an engineer. That's how your parents force you to.
Yeah.
So you would pick one. And I was, of course, interested in other. So picked engineering, didn't really know much about what's next. It was pretty much a socialist economy where I grew up. Electrical engineering was my major.
Mm-hmm.
And back in the day, you don't get many jobs. And everybody was actually forced to go abroad. And abroad at the time primarily meant U.S., so that's what I did. And, again, follow the crowd, did my computer engineering master's in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And then I got very much interested and really felt, what we're doing is working cutting edge technology. Mm-hmm. Went on to go work at Intel in their engineering division in Santa Clara and then in Oregon, designing microprocessors, mm-hmm. which at the time was the most cutting edge technology. It was the coolest thing to do.
At that point in time, there's not much better than that.
It was like, we were consumed in that world. But over the time, I also realized, saw the whole .com boom and bust happen around us.
Mm-hmm.
And we were kind of unscathed, but really come to terms with the fact that actually the value capture was moving away from infrastructure or hardware providers more towards the software where the more and more intelligence is.
Mm-hmm.
But I was already like almost, spent 10 years in engineering. So it was not an easy switch to convince anybody. So,
sure.
Pulled the typical, I would say the reset button at that point in career, which was an MBA.
Yeah.
Did my master's in INSEAD, Fontainebleau, France, and Singapore. Like any business school, there was a lot of partying, drinking, and traveling. Didn't really learn much, but made an unbelievable network. But was exposed to a lot of different avenues to go to.
Mm-hmm.
Since I was not so sure, picked consulting, and this time moved to the East Coast. Was based out of New York, but did a lot of international assignments because I was very much smitten by the opportunity to work abroad.
Mm-hmm.
Did a lot of projects for financial services firms and technology companies. Over the last 2 years at McKinsey was when I was more focused on sales-related projects.
Mm-hmm.
And when I decided to leave, because I left because I got married and didn't want to fly as much, I wanted to do a sales role. And not many would saw me like that. They either wanted me to be business operations or sales operations or strategy because of the strategy consulting experience. Joined AppNexus at the time, which was around 130, 140 people, and was given a small portfolio to work with. And because it went really well, I basically was kind of managing their biggest portfolio of books and helped them scale almost 4 or 5x in revenue in a span of 4 years and also the global team. So that was a good learning experience. It was more like being at the right place at the right time, applying all the knowledge you picked up. And it kind of made me as a scale-up expert.
Right.
And that's when Freshdesk happened, who had a similar scenario, great product market fit, very young and energetic team, and had all the right founders,
mm-hmm.
but they wanted to scale really fast.
Yeah.
And started having conversations with Girish, the founder, was really smitten by his vision and what he wanted for the company.
Mm.
So joined on board.
It's such an interesting background. And to me, like, there is this theme of like continual, I don't know if reinvention is the word, or I saw you use the word transformation,
yeah.
especially as well for how you kind of position yourself in business today around yeah. helping others.
Yeah.
How do you, like, is that something that you consciously chase, or like, how did that happen, do you think?
I would say I probably subconsciously chased that.
Okay.
Because I get bored in a way.
Mm.
At Intel, I was towards the end because the product cycle was 4 or 5 years long. It's like, you know, you work on conception, by the time it's actually on the street, it's like 4 years. It's a long cycle. Mm-hmm. So that was getting boring after you went through one cycle. And consulting was pretty exciting because it kept my, I was not getting bored because picked a variety of geographies, industries, functions, types of projects, growth and cost getting, all the whole nine yards. It was interesting up to a point, you know, what they say about consulting, right? It's like a treadmill where somebody's keep increasing the speed and the slope until you decide, okay, not for me anymore.
Sure, sure.
So that was the type when I switched. And it hit me that I never done sales. Uh-huh. And I was at a conversation with the VC. He was telling, you know, if he has to sell, teach one quality to his kid was, you know, critical thinking and then sales.
Okay.
And I asked him, why sales? He said, well, think about it. You're always selling something. I said, I was always equating sales to selling a gadget or a product. Mm-hmm. He was like, no, you're always trying to sell an idea to a VC, to your partner, to your friends. You're always constantly selling. And so that hit me. I was like, wow, that's true. I never thought about that.
Yeah.
So took that as a challenge, more or less, when I joined AppNexus. And of course, did my fair share of mistakes. It was not smooth sailing, but learned a lot over the time. So you can say that there is a little bit of a subconscious need to reinvent and go after new things. Mm. And even if you look at uprooting myself to move from US, you know, I could have easily gone for a C-level role for larger companies in the same industry, which was an ad tech, but chose not to do it because I really liked that experiences. And I said, I wanted to live in Europe for, mainland Europe experience.
Yeah. Do you think boredom is important for being a kind of catalyst of change in people's careers? Like, it seems like a lot of it for you was just reaching a stage where you were bored with what you were doing and you had to do something new.
I think boredom is important for you to reevaluate your a frame of reference, so to speak, because I had a very interesting career coach, and he's the one who told me that nobody teaches you about your career. And that was true, especially career transitions. When you come out of school, basically large corporates, they don't care about many things. They just ask, can you jump this high? Mm-hmm. And if you can jump a little higher, they'll hire you and so on and so forth, because they have the investment, the knowledge and the onboarding programs to shape the way you want. And so colleges never teach you too much about career transitions. So you basically on the field and you figure it out.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And what he taught me was to constantly reevaluate and reflect what's important to you holistically, not just from career. It's just one part of your life, you know, your personal life, everything together. And he said, whenever the life event changes, let's say you get married, have a child and so on, reevaluate and then see whether it fits. So now boredom gives you the luxury to do it because you have time to think about, you know, you're asking existential questions to yourself. Is this what I'm built to accomplish?
Yeah. Actually, I read something else here in the AMA that is kind of on the topic of like finding career happiness. I'm not sure if this is the same coach that you're referring to here, but you mentioned that you changed your approach when you left McKinsey, and then you say it wouldn't have happened if not for a coach who looked at my CV and asked if I was happy. It took me a while to answer, but that I realized I wasn't answering him directly. He clearly summarized my experience by saying, you've been collecting badges, continue to do so if that makes you happy. If not, this is the time to stop this. That was like a really powerful thing for me. And I just wondered, there is a thing here about you kind of visualizing what you want and then just going after it. Is that the order that things kind of happen?
Yeah. Okay. But if you go back before, it was a scarcity of opportunity, right? Where I grew up and the circumstances. So you take the least risky path. I don't think that's the same of the case with a lot of kids growing up in India now. They all want to be part of startups. Startups were not cool 20 years ago. It didn't exist back when I grew up. So there, you always were fine-tuned to make a most safest choice. So that's why, you know, go to a good school, pick engineering, pick a, you know, branch of engineering that sounds cool and go to US, you know, work for Intel or go to business school or go and work in McKinsey. It's all basically safe choices. There is no nothing unpredictable there. It's like if you get on that particular escalator, you will get there by so-and-so time.
Sure.
Right? So it was more like mindless optimization for you know, risk value type of thing. But after this aha moment, for me, it was more about like, say, well, I'm already, you know, I'm almost 40. I have to now switch towards what gives me happiness. So from being a risk-free, safe choices to what gives you happiness, that is a huge shift. And then you have to do everything other way around. And here he talked one thing about was like, be very specific on what you want and then network like crazy. And it's probably very simple, but he says the power of treat every person you talk to almost as a node, and you activate, not saying that, hey, I'm looking for a job. That's very uninteresting and forgettable. But if they're more specific, you paint a picture, you know, things do come through, and, you know.
And then just fast forwarding a little bit to here now in Berlin at Freshdesk, do you look for these same qualities in the people that you hire and the team that you build?
Interesting. I do look for one thing, which is people who are comfortable with change. And because for me, that's a proxy for the ability to learn. There is a people who know are the people who can learn. And there is even, I think Satya Nadella was referring to a book today. I forgot the name of the book. He talks about where the psychologist talks about two categories of people, know-it-all and learn-it-all. In this fast-changing world, the know-it-all might be good for some time, but they're going to come with a lot of baggage and assumptions. And since they know it all, they are probably not as open to learning it all. So it's an important distinction. And for me, the good proxy for that is how often they were able to change. Which means you have a confidence to walk away from what you have learned and seek something that's new and still learn and do it over and over.
So you're really looking for these signals of somebody perhaps turning their back on something that they've built up in their career to start something new.
Absolutely. So they are possibly in a comfortable position and they're bored and they realize this is not what makes them happy and they switch.
I was wondering if you have any books or kind of essays that you would recommend to people in a similar position. There's so many people out there evaluating their careers and perhaps they're bored or thinking about change. Is there anything that's helped you personally?
As to books, you know, nothing comes to mind in terms of the career transition itself. You know, but lately I've been reading other books around, you know, our biases and how we are. And that I'm like, I'm trying to apply that to the same principles to that. The key thing is, it's a Daniel Kahneman's book, you know, Think Fast, Think Slow. So it's about all the biases that we have. And, but when I apply it to our own personal life, we are fed with a lot of biases as we grow up, saying these are, for me, it was more like, you know, security, safety, and all the safe choices. But they were not true anymore at a certain point in life. And how do we work past that and all that stuff? There is another book, the name slips me right now. It's about, you know, maybe I can send it to you later. You can add it. It's I just picked it up again. This is another career coach who I happened to make the acquaintance through a friend and with whom I'm talking about this. And he said, you should talk to him. And he referred this book. I just ordered. Can send the name to you.
Yeah, that would be great. We'll put it in the notes of, of this episode. Is mentorship something that's been a big thing for you and something that you think is important?
I think it's absolutely important. The main reason is without a mentorship, you could still figure it out. You should still, you know, continue to grow, all that stuff. But it's always nice to have, you know, a coach who can look at things differently, who can come out of your mental bubble. And, you know, when you replay what you're looking for and they can piece that together based on how they see it. It's like this famous saying, you know, even Tiger Woods needs a coach type of thing, where even the best athletes and players, they have the coach. They're not better than them, obviously. But it's a perspective. You know, when you shift perspective, different interesting patterns emerge. And when you're open to it, you know, not mentorship for the sake of mentorship or networking, who can, you know, open doors, but really honest relationship where you can be open to somebody. Mm-hmm. I think that's quite powerful. It's not that easy to build such relationship to find to the people who have the time and the capability. Mm. But yes.
I think it's, I mean, from my perspective, it's pretty overwhelming to be faced with, to know that it's important, but at the same time to be faced with the challenge of finding that. Is there any advice you give to people that are looking for a mentor, or perhaps even from the other side, looking to help people out? Anything that these people can do?
My advice there is just ask. Oftentimes, again, going back, we are so scared of rejection. Mm. We are afraid to ask, but you'd be blown out of mind if you just reach out to somebody with a nicely written note, or reach out to them and say, hey, I really like your work and this is what I would like to do. And if you accept, you'd be surprised. And this was an advice given to me again by a coach. He was like, just ask. Mm-hmm. And then I realized how many people I was inspired by, and I was like, I never asked. So I basically self-selected myself out, but then I started reaching out, and using sales metric, the response rate was very, very high. And even if they decline, they politely, and you have established an amazing contact, that person views you very differently after that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And it's it obviously seems so obvious, but it's something that, like you said, we struggle with so much. Okay, so another thing I think it would be really cool to get your input on is, you've come here to Berlin to build a team basically from scratch for Freshdesk, and I'm sure there are a number of challenges along the way of doing that. I think one of them is this topic that is so prevalent right now, not just in new teams, but in existing teams, of diversity. Mm-hmm. I was wondering what you've learned around the idea of building a team that is like both culturally diverse and in today's age when it's such a huge topic.
I think it's I came in with the idea of making sure that we put in the groundwork to be diverse from day one, right? So I would say, proud to say where we are today. I think we are close to 17 people, and we are 60% women, I think 40% men. And we have something like 6-7 nationalities, people who speak like 12 languages. Mm. Of course, different functions, because we don't have too many salespeople. We have a mix of different functions. So it's as diverse as possible. And again, even though we were building with a notion of how to get us diverse, we didn't tweak any criteria at any point in time to hire somebody because they are, from a diverse background.
Yeah.
It just, we were opened our eyes to make it look, to look for everything that's out there. And there is a lot of work that's been done here and in US about how do you make sure that you don't discourage, for instance, even your job description when you put out there. If you say, rock stars and this and that, or if you say 3 years of experience required, studies have proven that women tend to not associate themselves with being a rock star, or they want to be more modest about their accomplishment.
Ninjas,
ninjas. And oftentimes it's like, if it is a 3-year experience is what you said as a minimum, and they have 2 years and 10 months, they don't apply. And men tend to apply even if they have 2.5 years. So it's the subtle things. So maybe that helped a little bit.
Yeah.
But we also have a good recruiting team who actually went far and wide. For us, I think we are well set, because what I hear is the first 10 or 20 hires sets the stage, because now they hire the next round of people and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So I'm very happy with the trajectory we are on right now. Yeah.
Yeah. It seems like an amazing diverse team that you've built there. And obviously that attracts diversity. Yeah. So.
And a place like Berlin actually makes it easy as well, because of diverse nationalities and people with different language skills. And it really makes a difference.
Yeah. And that's really cool. Obviously, as well, your team here is a remote team that acts probably quite separately from the core headquarters team. Is that something that's difficult for you? Like, there are obviously some challenges there as well. Are there any things that you've learned along the way, or perhaps surprises that you didn't expect in actually building and running a team that's fully remote?
Yeah, so this is a big learning for me. By nature, I'm an optimist. So, and also pretty ambitious and aggressive in growth. So when I set the goal for Europe, this is what we are going to do, I used some of my base assumptions based on my past experience, and which was primarily working in North America and primarily working in headquarters. So I said, okay, we'll go start. And then very quickly I realized, wow, it's different. Things move rather a little slower. Mm-hmm. And then when you're a satellite office, when there is a big mass in headquarters, mm-hmm. it's very difficult to get the attention because you are in a kind of catch-22 scenario. Because you are too small for the headquarters to notice, because the decisions they want to make and move on really fast. And you are more an exception and not part of the regular flow. And operating out of Europe has its own set of requirements that touches pretty much every part of the organization, straight from product, marketing, services, support, legal. So my touch points basically went and touched every function within the headquarters. Now, without a very strong supporter backing you and providing you with a mandate, it's very difficult, because then you are probably the one who's going to be viewed as somebody who is always the disruptor, saying, hey, what about Europe? When they launch a new product feature, I ask, hey, what about when it'll be available in the European data center, or when it'll be available in different languages, or legal, have you thought about GDPR? And it's all important, mm-hmm. but operating from a regional office has its challenges, and anyone who's intending to do that should factor that into their assumptions, because at the end of the day, success is between the gap between expectations and reality.
Sure.
If you set your expectations right, it's a good place to be.
And how should they adjust their expectations? I think you mentioned just to expect things to move much more slowly.
Yeah.
Is there anything more than that, or is it really just?
Well, there might be some scenarios where it may not also go your way how you want it, then you have to change your game plan to work with that. It's it's the adage of disagree and commit is probably happens more so for regional teams. Mm-hmm. Rather than for teams in the headquarters. I don't know any statistics. I'm just saying based on my point experiences. It's important to be prepared for things taking too long, things probably not going the way that's necessary for the market. Mm-hmm. And I would also say be prepared to spend any kind of goodwill and capital that you build with the different teams, because mm-hmm. Because you're going to be using it a lot when you have to fight for certain things.
Right. Yeah. No, that's definitely useful advice, I think, for people. We're pretty much out of time. I just wondered if you could just outline where the Freshdesk European business is today and what things look like for you guys moving forward. So I'm sure you have a lot of exciting things in the pipeline. And for anybody that's interested, feel free to just give them a quick overview of that.
Absolutely. So we planted, we moved here in May. It's just me. Mm-hmm. So our hiring started actually in earnest in Q4. So we are really ramped up only in Q1. So I would say we had a really good head start for this quarter. Q1 was our biggest quarter. And we basically, grew by 7x compared to Q4. Mm-hmm. And we are looking to double in Q2. Mm-hmm. In terms of both new customers and also the revenue. But what's more interesting is the quality of customers that are winning. We are winning some with some large unicorns and other companies who could potentially be our big reference clients, because we need that as we go into our mid-market and lower enterprise push. Yeah. And as our product matures, I think we have a pretty unbeatable, I would say, product and value combination for this market.
Yeah.
And the other thing that we are very excited about is the last 6-8 months is when we launched 4 more products. Mm-hmm. So we moved away from a single product company to a multi-product. Yeah. So we have Fresh Sales, which is our CRM, Fresh Service, which are IT service management, and also the chat and phone.
Yeah.
So when they all work together, especially for SMBs and fast growing companies, even in the mid-market segment, the proliferation of SaaS products is a big problem. Mm-hmm. Where there's too many and they don't talk to each other, you got to spend money to fix that. Mm. So I think we have a very compelling proposition across all different customer touch points. Mm. And that is going to only strengthen over time.
Cool. That's a big move for a SaaS business as well, to go from a single product to a multi-product business, I can imagine there are so many things to think about there. Both, I mean, initially, obviously, with my marketing hat on, it sounds like a headache already, but...
It's super complex. I think it's a topic big enough for a separate podcast.
Let's not dive into that right now.
Yeah.
Cool. Aaron, it's been really cool to chat to you here. I think I love the story and the philosophy behind it, not only of Freshdesk, but of yourself. And I think there's a lot of things that people can take away from this. So thanks so much.
Thank you, Ed.